It is kind of like an extra appendage, this mouse. I have two Razer mice, actually, and the one I'm currently using is called the, well, I just forgot, the Basilisk. And it has a clutch, they call it the clutch button on it, so you can basically just like assign that button to whatever you want. It's by like the thumb, so it's separate than the front or like the forward back buttons. It's down by where the tip of your thumb would be. And so for games and stuff, you can have it like when you push the clutch and it drops the DPI of the mouse or speeds of the DPI. It's pretty useful.
Yeah, I have a mouse. I have a Corsair or something like that that has a similar button. Like it's got a little sniper crosshair on it.
yeah, something like that. I really liked being able to change the sensitivity though on the fly with the other two buttons. Those, even just in working, I don't know. I like when I'm on my laptop, I like to have a slower mouse, but when I'm on an ultra wide monitor, I like to have a faster mouse.
Oh, that's interesting. I never really mess with my pointer speed in macOS.
Really?
It's just kind of, I don't know. It's, I guess, just whatever the default is at. Because I'm just using a laptop full time right now, and I almost never have a mouse connected to it unless I'm doing gaming stuff. I just use the trackpad.
Yeah, I normally have it like slapped all the way up. And it was always a thing with me and ZK. I would try to use his computer. He'd ask me how to do something, and I'd try to use his mouse. I'm like, I can't do this. I'd have to like put the mouse on the floor and slide it to move to the top left of the screen.
Oh yeah, that's how I have mine pretty much when I'm gaming though. Like if I'm doing any sort of FPS sort of stuff, I crank my DPS way down to like 500 or 600, I think.
Oh yeah.
Or not DPS, DPI rather. Way down to 500 or 600, because otherwise, I mean, I just can't get any precision otherwise.
Yeah, I do that too, but my clutch, I think my clutch drops it to like 300, and then I usually play around 600, so it just drops it in half. But you watch like any of the pro gamers, especially the Fortnite players, it's crazy because they use their elbow like a wrist. I can't do it. But anyhow, yeah, appendage. It's an extra appendage.
See, this is the problem. Like when we started the podcast at the very beginning, over 2.5 years ago or whatever now. Yeah, about 2.5. Oh my god, that's wild. I did some of the editing on my own. I cut out all our weird noises and silences and all that, and then sent that to Sarah, and she did a final edit. But now Sarah's actually not going to be editing the podcast anymore because of reasons that I don't know if I can talk about. But
sure,
yes, good reasons.
Yeah.
But Sarah's no longer going to be editing the podcast, and so we have a new editor coming on board who's going to be producing all this, assembling all of our weird mouth noises into hopefully a somewhat coherent podcast, and I'm pretty excited about that. It's a longtime friend and listener of the show, whose name we both have trouble pronouncing, Mikhail.
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 But if you're his mom, it's Mikhail. he very clearly said that to me, so there's no... I guess if he cuts us out, I don't know how he feels about it. But yeah, Mikhail, he's been active. He's been active for a while. What's really cool is that he kind of like answers questions for us. So like in our Spectrum chat, if someone asks a question, he's usually the first one to answer. And I'm usually just like, yeah, that's about right. Or even in the Vue.js Spectrum chat. And also the Elixir one too. He's just all over the place and he's like beating me to the punch every time, which I'm okay with.
Yeah, so he gets to have the pleasure of listening to us ramble on multiple times now, I guess.
I mean, we could have recorded the 26 minutes of pre-show before we actually started the show. We
could have and probably should have, right? I've been thinking about that. Like, we do have conversations. Maybe we should be recording.
What were we talking about? We were just complaining about audio problems, I guess, right? Discord's audio trouble thing. Like, sometimes it's not always consistent, and that was the problem. So we were just complaining about how there's always something.
It's amazing. Like, we've been doing this podcast, like I said, 2.5 years, and we still don't have, like, a super reliable audio situation.
Mm-hmm.
Discord most of the time works and has worked really great for us for quite a while. I think we've been using Discord primarily for over a year, right?
Yeah, something like that.
For a while. For a long time at this point. And it's generally pretty good. But the last couple of weeks... last week you were cutting out a lot for me, and then this week I was cutting out a lot for you, and so we've had to use Skype these episodes, and even then, like, Skype on my computer, the actual desktop version, just keeps crashing for some reason. So we're talking through a web browser right now. I'm logged into Skype in my browser, which I didn't even know was a thing until last week. But it works great.
I didn't know until you said it to me about 10 minutes ago.
Yeah, it's as good it seems every bit as good as Skype Desktop from the little bit I've used it so far. Pretty amazing that you can do that in a browser now.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems really cool. Thinking about how smooth Discord is usually and how smooth the video calls are. So I use it a lot for gaming too, just hopping in different channels and stuff. And it's always great until we need to record something and then it's not. But maybe, I mean, that could have also just been on my side as well. I don't know if it's, there was something weird going on with my interface where I jingled a dongle and I sounded like a robot screaming into a microphone for a minute for you. And I had to like swap all my cables out and unjingle the dongle. And then it started working. I don't really know what caused it, but.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I have that same kind of issue all the time with my like USB-C SD card reader, where if I like breathe on it wrong, it'll just disconnect. And I get, you know, I get the, you ejected this disk improperly or whatever. And it's like USB-C is so, so great when it's all working, but then it feels like just the slightest bump or wiggle or anything just destroys everything.
Yeah. I mean, at least I can use a microphone over RTC though, because I couldn't do that with FireWire. Remember, I don't know if it was the adapter that I have, but I just couldn't, like, any WebKit or, like, website-based RTC voice stuff would just, it would, like, chop out every other word, right?
Yeah, yeah, it was unlistenable. I mean, it was just completely not usable. And it's kind of amazing to me that something as simple as recording a weekly podcast can be a technical hurdle every single week for us, or almost every single week for us.
There's just always something. There's always something, no matter what you're doing. That's just the truism of life, I think. There's always something.
Well, there's always, I guess, like additional complexities that you don't expect, whether you're trying to record a podcast or you're doing dev stuff. I mean, it comes up all the time. You start on a project and you're like, okay, I think this will take me about 3 days, let's say. And then as you get into that and actually learn more about that project during that first day, you might find a bunch of things that you weren't expecting, that you couldn't have really even anticipated until you got kind of knee deep in things. And it's like, oh, well, this is actually going to take 5 days. And then that can kind of keep happening. And that's something that we've been, I feel like, dealing with a lot over the last week or two.
Yeah. Well, I think you more than me, because you've been doing the tag and material coloring cleanup, and we can kind of like frame that problem. I just still find it hilarious when I look at the tables in the database. But it's like that book I read, Dreaming in Code. It's just impossible to forecast. If there are any sort of unknowns, it's impossible to forecast anything accurately. And again, luckily our team is pretty flexible, and I guess they kind of have to be, right? Maybe that's not like a standout thing, like that we have a team that's like, oh yeah, that's fine if it takes an extra week. Maybe it's just, I don't know. I don't know if that just should be part of like what makes a good team or like what makes a team work. But I guess to frame the problem, we have for Design Collective, we have like a tagging system for products. And a long, long time ago, there was a bunch of stores that asked like, hey, can we add our own material? Can we add our own materials and colors to our products? Because the tags are separated into two categories, materials and colors. And so I said, sure, why not? And because of that, there are very many, just a large number of basically useless tags.
So there's I think it's 750-ish colors in the database right now, and something like 550 materials listed.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of the issue there, I wasn't even planning to clean these up originally. And that's sort of what I mean is like, this ended up being something that I had to clean up in order to do another project. I was actually focusing on improving our overall just search functionality. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of it was about design. But as I got into that, I kind of realized, well, because there's so many of these tags, hundreds and hundreds of these tags, if somebody types in leather, for example, in materials right now, they get a list of like 20 different leather. So it'll be like black leather or suede leather, you know, it's like all sorts of different types of leather, and which is fine. Like, it's kind of nice that we have that information because it is more data about each product, but it's completely unusable. Like, if somebody clicks on one of those, they're only going to see the specific one or two products that have that specific tag, whereas that's not really, in a filtering system, that's not really what you want as a user. You want to like click leather and see all the leather stuff. You want mm-hmm. a good result set, not just one or two things from that sort of filter, to be able to actually browse through them yourself.
And some of them were like, contains 98% polyester, so it's not even... like some of them were sentences. And the help text on the inputs, so we're using Vue's multi-select library. I'll link that in the show notes. But I mean, like I did a lot to describe, like, here's what a good tag looks like. Here's a good example of a color. Here's a good example of material. And it's obvious, like we've been saying this for a long time, that people just don't read instructional things. They don't read help text on forms. And
I mean, if you have a thing where they can type anything in, they're going to type anything in. That's the bottom line. You either have to restrict it or have to accept that you're going to get a lot of junk input. I think that's just right. kind of a reality of building applications.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I mean, part of it was because the MVP was built that way. It was just like a list of tags. And maybe it should have been like more of a plain texty type search where they can type as many tags as they want into a text box. And then the app uses that as sort of like a JSON B column or some sort of full text searching column for Postgres. But it just wasn't made that way.
Sure, sure. And I don't think it's inherently bad. I just think it's kind of useless to present it that way in a search.
Right.
And so when that came up during this redesign process, I actually had to kind of like explain to everybody like, okay, here's what's going on. And in order to properly redesign this thing, we have to actually make this technical change. And so what I ended up doing is I'm really excited about this actually, because this is our first, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure this is the first thing that's using any sort of machine learning stuff for Design Collective.
Yeah, you're correct.
Yeah. So it's actually using the Google, their natural language APIs. And for materials, it submits each one of the tags over to Google, and Google says, okay, so in the example of oak wood as a tag, Google will return separate entities, oak and wood, from that. And then, so I can figure out, or for example, stainless steel, it knows stainless isn't really a type of thing. It's not like a noun. Mm-hmm. But steel is. And so if there's a bunch of things that have steel or stainless steel, I can actually count the number of products that are in kind of each category and get back which categories are most relevant using this. And I don't want to go into too much detail about like the exact code or whatever,
sure.
just because, you know, it's a podcast. But it reduces the amount of what gets output to users in terms of the count of tags. For materials, it goes down to like 6%, I believe. Of the total list count before, but yet it actually within those tags that it presents, it shows a higher percentage of products than we actually even have in the store because of overlapping.
Right. Yeah.
So like if you see oak wood as a single tag would have only had a few products, but oak has a bunch more products because other things will have like oak wood planks or whatever.
Right.
And also it gets added, that signal gets added to wood as well. So you get you can really see pretty clearly, or a lot more clearly at least, which things are actually useful. And so now if people enter really descriptive tags, instead of that being bad, that's actually great because it gives us more data about each product, which we can use in the future, like you said, with full text search and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And right now it doesn't actually hurt the system. It still enriches the system if they type in a detailed tag, because we can pull the detail out of that tag and figure out which products it associates with. So I think it'll be a much better experience for users, but it was just totally unexpected to have to do that.
Right. Yeah. It was cool that you kind of pitched that idea too of using the cloud, Google's natural language API, because it's a perfect use case for that. And I think, I mean, there's a few things that you said that I really, really liked a lot about how you kind of described how it worked and what your plan was. I mean, the big thing is, like you said it was like 6% of... So it was like the materials that user would be able to use to search is like 6% of what it was. So I think it went from, like you said, 700 and something to like 34 or 36 materials, which I think is much more manageable, because a user, even if we provide them with like an autocomplete search for materials, like which one are they going to choose? 98% polyester, 100% polyester, you know? Mm-hmm. And the way the tagging system was originally built, and this was way before there was a ton of tags, It wasn't, if you selected polyester, it wouldn't also match the 98% polyester, and it wouldn't match the 100% polyester. So really, like when you selected a color material, you only saw one or two items. You didn't really see, like you said, another example was oak. So if you selected like oak plank, you wouldn't see anything else that was tagged with just oak. So that like obviously is a huge benefit to users, because now it helps them actually find what they're looking for in a much not only faster way, because you're kind of distilling a large data set into a smaller, more manageable data set for a person to use. So they're seeing more products, they're seeing more relevant products, which obviously is very important for Design Collective. But I think even perhaps the coolest thing about this, and I don't even think you mentioned this yet, but the way it's being set up is that we can run a job, like a recurring job once a week, to rescan all the tags and repopulate the data set. So the filtered kind of intelligent tags and filters that come out of this get updated on a weekly basis.
Yeah, and we can also just kick that off whenever. It's just each one of these is like a 100-line Elixir file. They're very, very simple, but it will hopefully be a very powerful thing for our visitors.
Yeah, and I think so. I think it's so cool because it helps the visitors, the users searching, because like no one's going to want to filter through 700 things. It's going to be overwhelming and too confusing, and just the results aren't good. So we make it simple for them, but also we still allow the store owners and the inventory managers to add products how they like to, and they like to be very specific on things. So like you said, now the more specific, so before the more specific they were, the worse it was for the platform, because it made it harder for users to find those products via the tags. Yet now, with this in place, they can be as specific as they want. The more, the better, because that means that their product is going to bubble up in more of the filters on the other side. So it's kind of like a win-win both sides. Yeah.
Yep. I mean, and this is all still theory. It doesn't exist in production yet, but so far it's looking extremely promising. And that's something I've been trying to do a lot lately. Is I want, instead of focusing on can I change a user's behavior? I just don't really think that's possible in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. And like, we can't tell the store. The only way we can limit what the store's input is by limiting what the store's input, like giving them basically a select dropdown that they can't type arbitrary things into.
Right.
And I think that's just the reality of it. And if we accept that instead of trying to fight it, like how can we solve the problem without trying to change their behavior? How can we make their behavior be beneficial to us and to the platform as a whole?
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we could have, there's other things maybe we could have done, but it would have been, again, another substantial amount of work. And I think this is a better payoff. Like maybe we could have done some smart things around actually the tagging interface. So suggestions in processing what someone's trying to create and be like, did you mean this? Surfacing stuff. And that's all stuff we can do eventually. But I think, you know, this doesn't add an extra barrier to the store. It removes a lot of barriers for the customer side of things, and it's transparent in the background. It just does what it's just a little robot doing its thing. It's doing what it was told whenever it was told to do it, which is pretty, I don't know, I find that very satisfying.
What's awesome to me is that like this sort of thing would have been very, very hard to automate, or at least a lot harder to automate even just a couple years ago. It's the level of technology that we have access to just via a Google API that we're going to use probably like a dollar or two's worth of every month.
Sure.
For this is just kind of mind blowing to me. It's really, really incredible the access that basically everyone has now.
Yeah. Just it's so, like you said, it's accessible. It's the machine learning stuff is a commodity now. You can go and you can get it, and it's no longer like a super expensive, complicated thing. You're able to like read some documentation and have pretty much working thing done inside of 2 days.
Yeah, I've only been working on this for a handful of days. The thing that took longer than actually writing the code was just figuring out like how can we actually solve this problem, and like what kind of results does Google return for the data that we're feeding it. And so it was a lot of manual playing with that and kind of figuring out, just connecting all the dots in my mind. Right.
Right. Yeah.
And that actually still kind of not scares me, but it's kind of a weird feeling to be deploying code that I know is going to change over time. Like the output will change just based on Google's learning and changing how they interpret things.
Yeah.
And so our actual tag output is going to change and get better just on its own, which is
hopefully
kind of a weird thing to think about. It's awesome, but it's also, I don't know, it's a little intimidating, I guess, in some ways.
It's not sentient, but it's no longer binary black and white. You can't expertly predict what the outcome is now, because I think you kept on saying black box. There's now a black box. We have no visibility as to how it works inside and as to how it's changing inside, and it's part of the process now.
Right. All I can do is observe what I'm passing into it and what I get back from it. But I know nothing about like how that actually happens internally, which is just strange, just very strange to me. But I mean, as long as we keep monitoring the output and are happy with it, that's all that really matters, I guess, in the end.
Yeah. And what's interesting is it kind of is directly the opposite of another conversation we had not too long ago in removing black box esque behavior from our platform. So there was, it was around the display dimensions, if I remember correctly. So there was, in shipping things, you have to have like a display dimension, which is the dimension of a thing that's put together. And you have to have a package dimension, which is the dimension of the thing taken apart per packaging. And the original MVP only had a single display dimension. And that obviously does not work for shipping anything, because you wouldn't ship a poster laid out flat and put in a box that way, you know?
Right. You wouldn't ship a lamp assembled in a lot of cases.
Right. You wouldn't ship a chandelier put together, you know, or anything really. So part of the solution, and another issue you have to deal with is like, how do we help store owners when they're adding their inventory? How do we help them predict what the package sizing will actually be? How do they know the act? Like, so when someone's paying for shipping, apart from using an API that allows you to purchase a box for shipping on checkout, which we didn't have at the time, how do we account for the package dimensions being larger and then coming to us and saying, oh, the shipping actually costs $4 more or $5 more or $10 more, you know? So part of the solution was, and this is obviously a very naive solution, but just add 4 inches to each dimension and have it. That's what the default shipping dimensions are. And if they need to customize it, they can. So another part of the solution was, let's just have it automatically add 4. So when you first create a product, it'll automatically add 4 to each side. But what happened was that information was lost somewhere along the way, and some of the inventory people weren't actually, their workflow, I don't know how it was exactly working, but they wouldn't actually enter dimensions on the first pass. They would go back and add them later. And so that means that the package dimensions would be 4. And so they would go back and they would add the display dimensions, but it wouldn't automatically recalculate the package dimensions, because then at that point, package dimensions have already been set. So you wouldn't want to automatically overwrite what was there before. So the use case was, if the package dimensions are nil, then add the display plus 4. And if they're not nil, then just keep them whatever they are, unless they're specifically overwritten. And that was like what I mean by kind of the black box there, because that's not obvious via a form. So it's not obvious for users to be able to guess how that works. And that caused a problem where someone bought something and the package dimensions were 4 inches. So they got charged very little for shipping. Luckily, it wasn't like a massive item or anything like that, but there was confusion as to like, how did this become 4, you know? And so we had to explain like, this is how it works, etc. And they were like, oh, we didn't know that. And so you and I had a big discussion about maybe we should.
And I mean, it makes sense that they wouldn't know that. Like, yeah, like you said, it's completely non-obvious.
It's not obvious. Yeah. I even had to go back and read through the code and be like, how does it work? Because it was one of those things where it was before you were around. So it was one of those things where I'm just completely slammed with just, there's just so many things to do. So most of my work was band-aiding things. And it, that's like, that was the only way to like be able to make progress on things, is band-aid a thing over here, so that way I can actually make progress over here on something that affects the bottom line in a positive manner. And yeah, it was not obvious. And so that was something that we kind of like decided ourselves in the future, like, let's not do that. Let's make it completely explicit. Let's not store any numbers unless the user specifically enters those numbers, etc.
Right. And for the application, for the backend, for stuff like search filters, I think it is really nice for that to seem and feel magic for us.
Yeah.
But I think stuff that is doing magic behind the scenes for users, whether that's like administrative users who are entering data or for visitors of the site, I think that's the sort of thing, that's the kind of black box we want to avoid.
Right. Yeah.
So we ended up changing how that whole system worked.
Yeah.
And no problem so far.
No problem so far. It's very obvious in how it works with the form. So I just moved that logic to the front end, because that's kind of like, it doesn't belong in the back end. The back end shouldn't be guessing. The back end should just store what it's given. And the front end is where we do any of the helping for that UI. So, I mean, there's like a toggle button. So we have a couple of view components and they're synced together. So if you change the display dimensions, it'll automatically recalculate the package dimensions. but you'll see it happening in the UI. You'll see it happening because they're right next to each other, so you'll see the numbers changing. And if you don't want that to happen, you click a checkbox, and it doesn't happen. So it's about as clear as it can get in terms of a user actually seeing what's changing and seeing numbers being synced together. And if they don't want that to happen, they just click a button, and it doesn't happen anymore. And I think that was the right way to solve the problem in the first place. It just wasn't. It's just one of those things where it was like a learning experience. Like maybe we, and this is obvious now, but like maybe we shouldn't just implement the first idea that comes into mind to solve a problem.
Well, and like you said, at the time you were a single developer, and almost all of your time was being spent just trying to stop the leaks.
That's a good way to put it.
Like it's so hard to think through. Like, oh, is this the optimal solution when your roof is leaking? Like, you just need to stop the leaks,
right?
And I think that now, thankfully, we are in a bit more of a position where we can take time and move a little bit slower and more thoughtfully on these things. And I think we've been doing that over the last couple months, definitely moving in that direction. And I think we've said this, like we've talked about this to each other at least. We're seeing the benefits of that now. Like we are having less issues in the site,
yeah,
in general, less emergencies, less fires.
Yeah, I haven't gotten any late night messages in the past like 3 weeks. I'm gonna knock on every tree on my way to the store later. But yeah, it's been I don't know, like there's a direct correlation between the pace at which we're working at and our stress levels and the pace at which we're working at and the number of hot fixes that go out.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's why I'm spending so much time on stuff like this search bar. It would be really easy to just throw together a new design for it that looked better, but that still had a lot of the same problems.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do things that look better or feel a little bit better, but still have a lot of the same problems. That's something I'm really, really trying to avoid.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's cool because I feel like the team's on the same page because they can actually see, they're actually seeing the results. The number of support requests that come in drop. That means that they can focus on their other work, whether it's selling or help, you know, onboarding new stores and stuff like that. So I think everyone kind of tangibly experiences the benefits of that, which is nice. And it's hard. It's like a constant fight to have to maintain that sort of culture that we have going. The kind of like the move slow and be careful about things and be considering of things, I think, is what we're trying to fight for. Because it's easy to default back to this thing is confusing to a user. Let's add this feature or let's change this feature in this way. And it's really hard to kind of keep everyone on the same page and saying, well, let's not change that just yet. Let's think about like, why are they confused about this? Is it a design? Is it actually a design problem? Is it a communication problem? Is it a wording problem? Is there a feature that doesn't exist that's causing them to be confused about this other thing?
Right, right. Are we just not meeting their expectations in some way?
Yeah, exactly.
That isn't totally related to this. And I think a lot of times that is the case.
Yeah.
Where it's like, if people can say this thing is bad, but that doesn't necessarily mean the thing is bad. That means that that something is making them feel that the thing is bad. And that's not always caused directly by the thing. I said the thing too many times there, but hopefully that was kind of clear.
I think by the thing you mean sort of assumptions that a user has or some sort of like default expectations that a user has. And those expectations vary wildly depending on the person, because we can have 1,000 people sign up and 2 people will ask the same question. And because 2 people ask the same question, then there's a sort of urgency sometimes put on that issue, when really there shouldn't be, because 998 people, 997 people were, you know, had no problems with it. So maybe there's like a minor change that needs to happen, or, you know, maybe that's just symptom of something else, but it's difficult. I hear people say, like, use the term like fighting for simplicity and fighting for like not adding band-aid, like, I don't know like how to use this in a single word, but like not slapping band-aid fixes on stuff, fighting for being able to consider things. And it is kind of like a fight a little bit, because you have to fight the natural instinct to be like, okay, well, there's a hole here, water's coming in, let me just stick my finger in it. Or let me put a piece of tape on it, which will eventually fall off, meaning I have to put another piece of tape on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you put that piece of tape over a leak, even if it stops it for a while, that water's got to go somewhere, and it's going to go into the rest of your roof. And it's going to eventually cause the rest of your roof to rot. So you're going to end up with a bigger problem unless you actually stop it at the root. And sometimes that requires, instead of having a 3-hour fix, having a, you know, a 1-week fix or something. Like,
yeah,
which is not always feasible and can't always be feasible. But when you can do that, I think you do often end up with better, just a better longer term fix.
Yeah. Yeah, you really do. And what's also cool is that I think in approaching things this way, we're also learning about other things as we go. So it's in kind of like patching a hole or putting a band-aid on something, you're only addressing that specific item. Whereas when you started looking at the search updates, you started identifying other things that also need to be addressed as well, or that are confusing and need to be cleaned up, or where designs need to change. So not only are you addressing the initial ask or the initial problem, but you're also finding other areas that can be cleaned up as well. And I think there's a huge benefit in that. Because it's again, it's kind of having a larger perspective. It's kind of having the bigger picture in view and not being so narrowly focused on one small thing.
Right. All of this stuff is interconnected in some way. It's all the stores and how they deal with the admin interface and what gets presented to the users and all everything in between there is all like kind of one thing. And like with this filter bar, it ended up that we basically need this for a project that you were working on as well, for adding some new functionality to the to what the stores see and how the stores view their products.
Yeah.
And because we're doing kind of this higher level thing where we approach this problem and spend time and really solve it instead of just doing a quick design change, we actually are going to be able to easily port that over and use it in multiple spots. So
yeah, it's going to be amazing. It's part of the bigger project to API all of it, which I'm kind of working on. Man, I think we talked about last time how you're doing a lot of product stuff, and I was kind of like sinking back into the platform and what we have right now and like kind of changing stuff. And I've been able to do that this week. I hit my goal. I have a Trello board where I want to move two cards every week to the done column, and that's converting views to like a Nuxt space or like a view based layout. So that way, eventually, we can port it straight to Nuxt. But also converting those views to have API endpoints, because eventually we're gonna need to split the client and the backend up. And it's one of those things where it's pretty important for the future for what we want to do for different things. But it's one of those things where I can't justify taking 3 weeks to do it at once. So
three weeks, I think, is even a little optimistic.
Yeah. Hey, man.
It's a big project.
I could do it.
I think it could probably be done, but that's a big haul.
It's a big haul, yeah. But it's cool because I've been able to do that. I've been able to focus on it, which it was, I don't know. I feel like the amount of focus I've had the last week has been greater than months before that.
That's awesome.
And I'm not exactly sure why that is. Maybe it's because I feel like I can actually focus solely on that thing. Because before I was trying to do like product work, I was trying to do CTO work, and I was trying to do just like VP of engineering work. And by that, I mean like cleaning up code, refactoring things, making sure things are working well. By product, I mean looking at features that need to change, looking at how the features work together, thinking about what we need, what we really need, not just like what people are saying, but like, what does that actually mean? And thinking about, okay, well, if we're going to move off Heroku eventually, how do we do that? There's just too much stuff, just too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's tough. Those context switches are killer for developer productivity.
Yeah.
It just wrecks your productivity so quickly to have even like one or two context switches in a day can just totally ruin you in some cases.
Yeah. So one thing I've been trying to do is time block stuff again. And I think I talked about this a long time ago, but now I think it's finally clicking for me. So I have a lot of time where I need to spend in Google Docs of all places. Spend a lot of time there these days. I have a lot of time where I need to spend emailing, following up with vendors that we work with saying, hey, did you do this thing yet? I just spend a lot of different time in different places, some time in Figma, some time in actually writing code. So what I'm trying to do is schedule out things. So if I know that it's hard for me to write code in the afternoons, maybe that's when I should spend time in Google Docs. And if I'm really good at writing code in the morning and able to focus in really hard in the morning, maybe that's when I should be writing code. So I'm trying to think about, okay, what do I need to do today? And when can I slot that in, knowing when I'm productive and when I'm not productive? And I think also that's part of why I've been feeling productive, because I'm kind of like preempting my laziness in the afternoons with writing and things that aren't like, I mean, it's not like I'm not thinking, but it's definitely it doesn't require as much focus as writing code.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's interesting that you talk about focus and writing code in that way, because we've been doing a lot of meetings while I'll be like driving. So I'll be in the back of the van while Charlene is driving while we're going down the road. I'm not driving while we're having these meetings.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're having a meeting where it's about like businessy kind of stuff where it's the whole team and we're just chatting about, like, you know, features and ideas and product stuff, that kind of thing, completely fine. And I'll be looking at my computer, browsing through documents, sending links, all that. And it's not a big deal. But then if we try to pair, I get car sick every single time. And I think the reason for that is just because of the kind of focus that like watching code be written takes.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not on a phone call, if I'm just writing code on my own, it's fine as well, because then I'm able to look up more frequently than I would, you know,
it
just sitting still in an office.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, it just is, it really is a tremendous amount of focus to be looking at code in that way, in a way that just writing or something isn't, at least for me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I don't know why it is about the afternoons. I've been doing this for a little while now too, where I don't eat breakfast anymore. I only eat between like 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. and I feel really good. And I usually don't have like a massive crash in the afternoons anymore. I just, maybe because the weather's been really nice the last week. I don't want to be in here. I don't know what it is, but yeah, like the writing code for me, if I'm just like in the afternoons, if I have the editor open, maybe I'm typing a little bit, but I'm not really accomplishing much.
Yeah, that can be tough. It's so, sometimes you just feel like you should be doing something more in a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this feeling all the time. And it's like, it can just be good to like spend some time and go through some emails that you haven't gotten to, or spend some time and block off an hour for Google Docs updates. And you're using Google Docs for like writing about new features and even old features and just how they work, like design documents, basically.
Yeah.
And that can be a fantastic use of that time. I think that's awesome.
I mean, it already, like, it has shown to be so far, because I ask, like, how is this helpful to you? And they're like, yeah, this is super nice. So I'm basically just making an internal knowledge base in Google Docs. I'm using that because it's collaborative. I can ping people, they can comment, respond, all that stuff. And there's like 100 apps out there that do that for Teams, but Google Docs already integrates with how they work. And I wanted to not force them to have to use something new.
Everybody knows and likes Google Docs, at least, or at least doesn't dislike Google Docs too strongly.
Right.
It's just, it's like very, very agnostic. It's not super opinionated. It just does the thing that you would want it to do.
Right. Yeah.
And it does it pretty well.
It works well enough. And that's all, that's a pretty, pretty okay review of it. Anyhow, it is really nice outside.
Well, then you should probably get outside, man. It's super cloudy here and we've gotten like 14 watts of solar all day. So you should go enjoy that sunshine.
You know, when you do get up here, there's like three major solar farms up here, like solar arrays. You could probably just like park that van up in there.
Just like camouflage. Yep. Blend right in. I love it. All right, man. Talk to you later.
All right, see ya.